As we remain where? I shook the ball once more. It provided the answer, outlook not so good. I put the magic eight ball back in Agamethus's hands, which was like pressing against the wind from a moving vehicle. I can't play guessing games right now. He did not have a face, but his posture seemed forlorn. The blood from his severed neck trickled sluggishly down his tunic. I imagined Trophonius's head transposed on his body. My son's agonized voice crying to the heavens. Take me instead. Save him, father, please. This blended with the face of Commodus, staring at me, wounded and betrayed as his carotid pulse hammered against my hands. You blessed me. I sobbed and hugged the commode, the only thing in the universe that wasn't spinning. Was there anyone I hadn't betrayed and disappointed? Any relationship I hadn't destroyed? After a miserable eternity in my private toilet verse, a voice spoke behind me. Hey. I blinked away my tears. Agamethus was gone. In his place, leaning against the sink, was Josephine. She offered me a fresh roll of toilet paper. I sniffled weakly. Are you supposed to be in the men's room? She laughed. Wouldn't be the first time, but our bathrooms are gender neutral here. I wiped my face and clothes. I didn't accomplish much beyond toilet papering myself. Josephine helped me into a sitting position on the toilet. She assured me this was better than hugging it, though at the moment I saw little difference. What happened to you? She asked. Not having any concerns about my dignity, I told her. Josephine pulled a cloth from her coverall pocket. She wet it at the sink and began cleaning the sides of my face, getting the places I'd missed. She treated me as if I were her 7-year-old Georgie, or one of her mechanical crossbow turrets. Something precious, but high maintenance. I'm not going to judge you, Sonny. I've done a few bad things in my time. I studied her square-jawed face, the metallic sheen of her gray hair against her dark skin. She seemed so gentle and affable, the same way I thought of Festus the dragon. Yet at times I had to step back and remember, oh, right, this is a giant fire-breathing death machine. Leo mentioned gangsters, I recalled. Al Capone? Josephine smirked. Yep, Al, and Diamond Joe, and Papa Johnny. I knew them all. I was Al's, what would you call it, liaison to the African-American bootleggers. Despite my dour mood, I couldn't help feeling a spark of fascination. The jazz age had been one of my favorites because, well, jazz. For a woman in the 1920s, that's impressive. The thing is, Joe said, they never knew I was a woman. I had a sudden image of Josephine in black leather shoes with spats, a pinstripe suit, a diamond-studded tie pin, and a black fedora. Her submachine gun, Little Bertha, propped against her shoulder. I see. They called me Big Joe. She gazed at the wall. Perhaps it was just my state of mind, but I imagined her as Commodus, throwing a pitcher so hard it cracked the tiles. That lifestyle. It was intoxicating, dangerous. It took me to a dark place, almost destroyed me. Then Artemis found me and offered me a way out. I remembered Hemethea and her sister Parthenos launching themselves over a cliff, in a time when women's lives were more expendable than jars of wine. My sister has saved many young women from horrible situations. Yes, she has. Joe smiled wistfully. And then Emmy saved my life again. You two could still be immortal, I grumbled. You could have youth, power, eternal life. We could, Josephine agreed. But then we wouldn't have had the past few decades of growing old together. We've had a good life here. We've saved a lot of demigods and other outcasts, raised them at the way station, let them go to school and have a more or less normal childhood, then sent them out into the world as adults with the skills they needed to survive. I shook my head. I don't understand. There's no comparison between that and immortality. Josephine shrugged. It's okay if you don't get it. But I want you to know, Emmy didn't give up your divine gift lightly. After 60-odd years together with the Hunters, we discovered something. It's not how long you live that matters. It's what you live for. I frowned. That was a very ungodly way of thinking. As if you could have immortality or meaning, but not both. Why are you telling me this? I asked. Are you trying to convince me that I should stay as this abomination? I gestured at my pathetic mortal body. I'm not telling you what to do. But those folks out there, Leo, Calypso, Meg, they need you. They're counting on you. Emmy and I are too, to get our daughter back. You don't have to be a god. Just do your best for your friends. Ugh. Joe chuckled. Once upon a time, that kind of talk would have made me throw up, too. I thought friendship was a trap. Life was every woman for herself, but when I joined the Hunters, Lady Britta Martis told me something. You know how she first became a goddess? I thought for a moment. She was a young maiden running to escape the King of Crete. To hide, she jumped in a fishing net in the harbor, didn't she? Instead of drowning, she was transformed. Right. Joe intertwined her fingers like a cat's cradle. Nets can be traps, but they can also be safety nets. You just have to know when to jump in. I stared at her. I waited for a moment of revelation when everything would make sense and my spirits would be lifted. Sorry, I said at last. I have no idea what that means. That's okay, she offered me a hand. Let's get you out of here. Yes, I agreed. I'd like a good long sleep before our trip tomorrow. Joe grinned her affable killing machine smile. Oh, no. No sleep yet. You've got afternoon chores, my friend. 20. Pedaling in style. Leg irons are fashionable. Cue the screaming god. At least I didn't have to clean toilets. I spent the afternoon in the Griffin Roost, playing music for Heloise to keep her calm while she laid her egg. She enjoyed Adele and Joni Mitchell, which strained my human vocal cords considerably, but she had no use for my impersonation of Elvis Presley. Griffin musical tastes are a mystery. Once I spotted Calypso and Leo down in the Great Hall, walking with Emmy, the three of them deep in conversation. Several times I saw Agamethus float through the hall, wringing his hands. I tried not to think about his magic eight ball message, "We cannot remain," which was neither cheerful nor helpful when one was trying to provide egg-laying mood music. About an hour into my second set, Joe resumed the manufacture of her tracking device in the workshop. which necessitated me finding tunes that went well with the sound of a welding torch. Fortunately, Heloise enjoyed Patti Smith. The only person I didn't see during the afternoon was Meg. I assumed she was on the roof, making the garden grow at 5 times its normal rate. Occasionally, I glanced up, wondering when the roof might collapse and bury me in rutabagas. By dinner time, my fingers were blistered from playing my combat ukulele. My throat felt like Death Valley. However, Heloise was clucking contentedly on top of her newly laid egg. I felt surprisingly better. Music and healing, after all, were not so different. I wondered if Joe had sent me to the roost for my own good as well as Heloise's. Those waystation women were tricky. That night, I slept like the dead. The actual dead, not the restless, headless, glowing orange variety. By first light, armed with Emmy's directions to the canal walk, Meg, Leo, and I were ready to navigate the streets of Indianapolis. Before we left, Josephine pulled me aside. "Wish I was going with you, Sonny. I'll do my best to train your friend Calypso this morning. See if she can regain control over her magic. While you're gone, I'll feel better if you wear this." She handed me an iron shackle. I studied her face, but she did not seem to be joking. "This is a griffin manacle," I said. "No, I would never make a griffin wear a manacle." "Yet you're giving me one. Don't prisoners wear these for house arrest?" "That's not what it's for. This is the tracking device I've been working on." She pressed a small indentation on the rim of the shackle. With a click, metallic wings extended from either side, buzzing at hummingbird frequency. The shackle almost leaped out of my hands. "Oh no," I protested. "Don't ask me to wear flying apparel. Hermes tricked me into wearing his shoes once. I took a nap in a hammock in Athens and woke up in Argentina. Never again." Joe switched off the wings. "You don't have to fly." The idea was to make 2 ankle bracelets, but I didn't have time. I was going to send them off to... She paused, clearly trying to control her emotions. "To find Georgina and bring her home. Since I can't do that, if you get in trouble, if you find her..." Joe pointed to a second indentation on the manacle. "This activates the homing beacon. It'll tell me where you are, and you'd better believe we'll send reinforcements." I didn't know how Josephine would accomplish that. They didn't have much of a cavalry. I also did not want to wear a tracking device on general principle. It went against the very nature of being Apollo. I should always be the most obvious, most brilliant source of light in the world. If you had to search for me, something was wrong. Then again, Josephine was giving me that look my mother Leto always pulled when she was afraid I'd forgotten to write her a new song for Mother's Day. It's kind of a tradition, and yes, I am a wonderful son, thanks. "Very well." I fastened the shackle around my ankle. It fits snugly, but at least that way I could hide it under the hem of my jeans. "Thank you." Joe pressed her forehead against mine. "Don't die." Then she turned and marched purposefully back to her workshop, no doubt anxious to create more restraining devices for me. Half an hour later, I discovered something important. One should never wear an iron manacle while operating a pedal boat. Our mode of transportation was Leo's idea. When we arrived at the banks of the canal, he discovered a boat rental dock that was shut down for the season. He decided to liberate a teal plastic pedal boat and insisted we call him the Dread Pirate Valdez. Meg loved this. I refused. This is the best way to spot that secret entrance, great thing, he assured us as we pedaled along. At water level, we can't miss it. Plus, we're traveling in style. We had very different ideas of traveling in style. Leo and I sat in the front, operating the pedals. Under the iron manacle, my ankle felt like it was being slowly chewed off by a Doberman pincher. My calves burned. I did not understand why mortals would pay money for this experience. If the boat were pulled by hippocampi, perhaps, but physical labor? Ugh. Meanwhile, Meg faced the reverse direction in the back seat. She claimed she was scouting hour 6 for the secret entrance to the sewers, but it looked an awful lot like she was relaxing. So what's with you and the Emperor? Leo asked me, his feet pedaling merrily along as if the exertion didn't bother him at all. I wiped my brow. I don't know what you mean. Come on, man. At dinner, when Meg started shouting about commodes, you ran straight to the bathroom and spewed. I did not spew. It was more like heaving. Ever since, you've been awfully quiet. He had a point. Being quiet was another un-Apollo-like trait. Usually I had so many interesting things to say and delightful songs to sing. I realized I should tell my companions about the Emperor. They deserved to know what we were pedaling into. But forming the words was difficult. Commodus blames me for his death, I said. Why? Meg asked. Probably because I killed him. Ah, Leo nodded sagely. That would do it. I managed to tell them the story. It wasn't easy. As I stared ahead of us, I imagined the body of Commodus floating just below the surface of the canal, ready to rise from the icy green depths and accuse me of treachery. You blessed me. When I was done with the story, Leo and Meg remained silent. Neither of them screamed murderer. Neither of them looked me in the eye, either. That's rough, man, Leo said at last. But it sounds like Emperor Toilet needed to go. Meg made a sound like a cat sneeze. It's Commodus. He's handsome, by the way. I glanced back. You've met him? Meg shrugged. At some point since yesterday, a rhinestone had fallen out of her glasses frames, like a star winked out of existence. It bothered me that I'd noticed such a small detail. Once, she said, in New York, he visited my stepfather. Nero, I urged. Call him Nero. Yeah. Red blotches appeared on her cheeks. Commodus was handsome. I rolled my eyes. He's also vainglorious, puffed up, egotistical. So he's like your competition then? Leo asked. Oh, shut up. For a while, the only sound on the canal was the chugging of our pedal boat. It echoed off the 10-foot-high embankments and up the sides of brick warehouses that were in the process of conversion to condominiums and restaurants. The building's dark windows stared down at us, making me feel both claustrophobic and exposed. One thing I don't get, Leo said. Why Commodus? I mean, if this triumvirate is the three biggest and baddest emperors, the Roman supervillain dream team, Nero makes sense. But Commode Man? Why not some eviler, more famous guy, like Murderous Maximus or Attila the Hun? Attila the Hun was not a Roman emperor, I said. As for Murderous Maximus, well, that's actually a good name, but not a real emperor. As for why Commodus is part of the triumvirate, they think he's weak, Meg said. She kept her gaze on our wake, as if she saw her own assortment of faces below the surface. "You know this, how?" I asked. "My step Nero told me. Him and the third one, the Emperor in the West. They wanted Commodus between them." "The third Emperor," I said. "You know who he is?" Meg frowned. "I only saw him once. Nero never used his name. He just called him my kinsman. I think even Nero is afraid of him." "Fantastic," I muttered. Any emperor who scared Nero was not someone I wanted to meet. "So Nero and the dude in the West," Leo said. "They want Commodus to be a buffer between them. Monkey in the middle." Meg rubbed her nose. "Yeah, Nero told me. He said Commodus was like his peaches. A vicious pet, but controllable." Her voice wavered on the name of her Carpos companion. I was afraid Meg might order me to slap myself or jump in the canal, but I asked, "Where is Peaches?" She stuck out her lower lip. "The beast. Nero," I corrected gently. "Nero took him. He said I didn't deserve a pet until I behaved." Anger made me pedal faster, made me almost welcome the chafing pain on my ankle. I didn't know how Nero had managed to imprison the grain spirit, but I understood why he'd done it. Nero wanted Meg to depend entirely on him. She wasn't allowed to have her own possessions, her own friends. Everything in her life had to be tainted with Nero's poison. If he got his hands on me, no doubt he would use me the same way. Whatever horrible tortures he had planned for Lester Papadopoulos, they wouldn't be as bad as the way he tortured Meg. He would make her feel responsible for my pain and death. "We'll get Peaches back," I promised her. "Yeah, chica," Leo agreed.
"The dread pirate Valdez never abandons a crew member."
"Don't you worry about..."
"Guys?"
Meg's voice took on a sharp edge.
"What's that?"
She pointed to starboard. A line of chevrons rippled on the green water, like an arrow had been shot horizontally across the surface.
"Did you see what it was?" Leo asked.
Meg nodded.
A fin, maybe? Do canals have fish?"
I didn't know the answer, but I didn't like the size of those ripples. My throat felt as if it were sprouting fresh wheat shoots. Leo pointed off the bow.
"There."
Right in front of us, about half an inch below the surface, green scales undulated, then submerged. "That's not a fish," I said, hating myself for being so perceptive.
"I think that's another part of the same creature."
"As over there?"
Meg pointed again to starboard. The two disturbances had happened at least 40 feet apart. That would mean something bigger than the boat. Leo scanned the water. "Apollo? Any idea what that thing is?"
"Only a hunch," I said. "Let's hope I'm wrong. Pedal faster. We have to find that grate."
21. Get me a legion. And about 6 tons of rocks. Need to kill a snake. I do not like serpents. Ever since my famous battle with Python, I've had a phobia of scaly reptilian creatures. Especially if you include my stepmother, Hera. Boom! I could barely tolerate the snakes on Hermes's Caduceus, George and Martha. They were friendly enough, but they constantly pestered me to write a song for them about the joy of eating rats. A joy I did not share. I told myself the creature in the central canal wasn't an aquatic serpent. The water was much too cold. The canal didn't offer enough tasty fish to eat. On the other hand, I knew Commodus. He loved to collect exotic monsters. I could think of one particular river serpent he would love. One that might easily sustain itself by eating tasty pedal boaters.
Bad Apollo, I told myself. Stay focused on your mission.
We chugged along for another 50 feet or so, long enough for me to wonder if the threat had been imaginary. Perhaps the monster had been nothing more than an abandoned pet alligator. Did they have those in the Midwest? Very polite ones, perhaps? Leo nudged me. Look over there. On the far embankment wall, peeking above the waterline, was the brick archway of an old sewer main, the entrance blocked by golden bars. How many sewers have you seen with gold grates on them? Leo asked. Betcha that one leads right to the Emperor's palace. I frowned. That was much too easy. Hey! Meg poked me in the back of the neck. Remember what Percy told us? Never say stuff like, we made it, or that was easy. You'll jinx us. My entire existence is a jinx. Pedal faster. Since that was a direct order from Meg, I had no choice. My legs already felt like they were turning into sacks of hot coals, but I picked up the pace. Leo steered our teal plastic pirate ship toward the sewer entrance. We were 10 feet away when we triggered the first law of Percy Jackson. Our jinx rose from the water in the form of a glistening arc of serpentine flesh. I may have screamed. Leo shouted a completely unhelpful warning. Look out! The boat tilted sideways. More arcs of serpent flesh breached around us. Undulating hills of green and brown, ridged with serrated dorsal fins. Meg's twin blades flashed into existence. She tried to stand, but the pedal boat capsized, plunging us into a cold green explosion of bubbles and thrashing limbs. My only consolation, the canal was not deep. My feet found the bottom, and I was able to stand, gasping and shivering, the water up to my shoulders. Nearby, a 3-foot diameter coil of serpent flesh encircled our pedal boat and squeezed. The hull imploded, shattering teal plastic with the sound like firecrackers. One shard stung my face, narrowly missing my left eye. Leo popped to the surface, his chin barely at water level. He waded toward the sewer grate, climbing over a hill of serpent flesh that got in his way. Meg, bless her heroic heart, slashed away at the monster's coils, but her blades just skidded off its slimy hide. Then the creature's head rose from the canal, and I lost all hope that we would be home in time for tofu enchilada night. The monster's triangular forehead was wide enough to provide parking for a compact car. Its eyes glowed as orange as Agamethus's ghost. When it opened its vast red maw, I remembered another reason I hate serpents. Their breath smells worse than Hephaestus's work shirts. The creature snapped at Meg. Despite being neck-deep in water, she somehow sidestepped and thrust her left-handed blade straight into the serpent's eye. The monster threw its head back and hissed. The canal boiled with snake flesh. I was swept off my feet and submerged once more. When I came to the surface, Meg McCaffrey stood at my side, her chest heaving as she gasped for air. Her glasses crooked and filmed with canal water. The serpent's head flailed from side to side as if trying to shake the blindness out of its wounded eye. Its jaw smacked against the nearest condominium building, shattering windows and webbing the brick wall with cracks.
A banner along the roof line said, "Leasing soon." I hoped that meant the building was empty. Leo made it to the grate. He traced his fingers along the golden bars, perhaps looking for buttons or switches or traps. Meg and I were now 30 feet away from him, which seemed a great distance over the vast serpentine terrain. "Hurry!" I called to him.
"Gee, thanks," he yelled back. "I didn't think of that."
The canal churned as the serpent drew in its coils. Its head rose 2 stories above us. Its right eye had gone dark, but its glowing left iris and its hideous maw reminded me of those pumpkin things mortals make for Halloween. Jack-o'-lanterns? A silly tradition. I always preferred running around in goat skins at Februalia. Much more dignified. Meg stabbed at the creature's underbelly. Her golden blade only sparked against it.
"What is this thing?" she demanded.
"The Carthaginian serpent," I said. "One of the most fearsome beasts ever to face Roman troops. In Africa, it almost drowned an entire legion under Marcus Atilius Regulus.
Don't care."
Meg and the serpent eyed each other warily, as if a giant monster and a 12-year-old girl were well-matched opponents.
"How do I kill it?"
My mind raced. I didn't do well in panic situations, which meant most of the situations I had been in recently.
I think the Legion finally crushed it with thousands of rocks. "I don't have a Legion," Meg said, "or thousands of rocks."
The serpent hissed, spraying venom across the canal. I unslung my bow, but I ran into that pesky maintenance issue again. A wet bowstring and arrows were problematic, especially if I planned to hit a target as small as the serpent's other eye. Then there were the physics of firing a bow while shoulder-deep in water. "Leo?" I called.
"Almost!"
He banged a wrench against the grate.
"Keep it distracted!"
I gulped.
"Meg, perhaps if you could stab its other eye or its mouth?" "While you do what? Hide?"
I really hated how this young girl could get inside my brain.
"Of course not. I'll just be,
The serpent struck. Meg and I dove in opposite directions. The creature's head caused a tsunami between us, somersaulting me through the water. I swallowed a few gallons of the canal and came up spluttering, then gagged in horror when I saw Meg encircled in the snake's tail. The serpent lifted her out of the water, bringing her level with its remaining eye. Meg slashed wildly, but the monster kept her out of striking distance. It regarded her as if thinking, "What is this stoplight-colored thing?" Then it began to squeeze. Leo yelled,
"I got it!"
Clang. The grate's golden bars swung inward. Leo turned, grinning in pride, then saw Meg's predicament.
"Nuh-uh!"
He raised his hand above the water and tried to summon fire. All he managed was a puff of steam. He threw a wrench that bounced harmlessly off the snake's side. Meg yelped. The snake's tail constricted around her waist, turning her face tomato red. She hammered her swords uselessly against the monster's hide. I stood paralyzed, unable to help, unable to think. I knew the strength of such a serpent. I remembered being wrapped in python's coils, my divine ribs cracking, my godly ichor being squeezed into my head and threatening to spurt out my ears.
"Meg!"
I shouted.
"Hold on!"
She glared down at me, her eyes bulging, her tongue swollen, as if thinking, like I have a choice. The serpent ignored me, no doubt too interested in watching Meg implode like the pedal boat. Behind the snake's head rose the damaged brick wall of a condominium.
The sewer entrance stood just to the right of that. I remembered the tale of the Roman legion that had once fought this thing by showering it with stones. If only that brick wall were part of the way station, and I could command it. The idea seized me like a coil of the monster.
Leo!
I yelled.
Get in the tunnel!
But...
do it!
Something began to swell inside my chest. I hoped it was power and not my breakfast. I filled my lungs and bellowed in the baritone voice I usually reserved for Italian operas.
Begone, snake! I am Apollo!
The frequency was perfect. The wall of the warehouse trembled and cracked. A 3-story tall curtain of bricks peeled away and collapsed onto the serpent's back, pushing its head underwater. Its coiled tail loosened. Meg dropped into the canal. Ignoring the rain of bricks, I waded forward, quite bravely, I thought, and pulled Meg to the surface.
Guys, hurry, Leo yelled. The grate's closing again.
I dragged Meg toward the sewer, because that's what friends are for. As Leo did his best to wedge the grate open with a tire iron. Thank goodness for scrawny mortal bodies. We squeezed through just as the bars locked into place behind us. Outside, the serpent surged upward from its baptism of bricks. It hissed and banged its half-blind head against the grate, but we did not linger to chat. We forged on into the darkness of the Emperor's waterworks. 22. I wax poetic on the beauty of sewers. Real short poem. Done. Wading shoulder deep through freezing sewer water, I felt nostalgic for the Indianapolis Zoo. Oh, for the simple pleasures of hiding from murderous Germani, crashing miniature trains, and serenading angry griffins. Gradually, the sound of the serpent banging on the grate faded behind us. We walked for so long, I feared we'd die of hypothermia before reaching our goal. Then I spotted a raised alcove built into the side of the tunnel. An old service platform, maybe. We climbed out of the frigid green muck for a break. Meg and I huddled together while Leo attempted to light himself on fire. On his 3rd try, his skin sputtered and hissed, finally bursting into flames. Gather round, children. His grin looked diabolical, with orange fire washing across his face. Nothing like a blazing hot Leo to warm you up. I tried to call him an idiot, but my jaw was shivering so badly, all that came out was, it. Soon our little alcove was infused with the smell of reheated Meg and Apollo. Baked apples, mildew, body odor, and just a hint of awesomeness. I'll let you guess which scent was my contribution. My fingers turned from blue back to pink. I could feel my legs well enough again to be bothered by the chafing from the iron shackle. I was even able to speak without stuttering like Josephine's Tommy gun. When Leo judged us sufficiently dry, he shut off his personal bonfire. Hey, Apollo. That was nice work back there. Which part? I said. The drowning? The screaming? Nah, man. How you collapsed that brick wall. You should do that more often. I plucked a teal plastic shard from my coat. As an annoying demigod once told me, gee, why didn't I think of that? I've explained before, I can't control those bursts of power. Somehow, in that moment, I found my godly voice. Brick mortar resonates at a certain frequency. It's best manipulated by a baritone at 125 decibels.
You saved me,
Meg interrupted.
I was going to die. Maybe that's why you got your voice back.
I was reluctant to admit it, but she might have been right. The last time I'd experienced a burst of godly power in the woods of Camp Half-Blood, my children, Kayla and Austin, had been in imminent danger of burning alive. Concern for others was a logical trigger for my powers. I was, after all, selfless, caring, and an all-around nice guy. Nevertheless, I found it irritating that my own well-being wasn't sufficient to give me godly strength. My life was important, too. "Well," I said, "I'm glad you weren't crushed to death, Meg. Anything broken?" She touched her ribcage.
"Nah, I'm good."
Her stiff movements, her pale complexion, and the tightness around her eyes told me otherwise. She was in more pain than she would admit. However, until we got back to the waystation infirmary, I couldn't do much for her. Even if I'd had proper medical supplies, wrapping the ribs of a girl who'd almost been crushed to death might do more harm than good. Leo stared at the dark green water. He looked more pensive than usual. Or perhaps it was just the fact that he wasn't on fire anymore. "What are you thinking about?" I asked. He glanced over. No snappy comeback, no playful grin. "Just Leo and Calypso's garage? Auto repair and mechanical monsters?" "What?" "Something Cal and I used to joke about." It didn't sound like a very funny joke. Then again, mortal humor wasn't always up to my godly standards. I recalled Calypso and Leo deep in conversation with Emmy yesterday as they walked through the Great Hall. "Something to do with what Emmy was telling you?" I ventured. He shrugged. "Stuff for the future. Nothing to worry about." As a former god of prophecy, I'd always found the future a wonderful source of worry. But I decided not to press the issue. Right now, the only future goal that mattered was getting me back to Mount Olympus so the world could once again bask in my divine glory. I had to think of the greater good. "Well," I said, "now that we're warm and dry, I suppose it's time to get in the water again."
"Fun,"
Meg said. She jumped in first. Leo led the way, keeping one burning hand above the water for light. Every so often, small objects floated up from the pockets of his tool belt and drifted past me. Velcro tabs, styrofoam peanuts, multicolored twist ties. Meg guarded our backs, her twin swords gleaming in the darkness. I appreciated her fighting skills, but I did wish we had some additional help. A demigod child of the sewer goddess Cloacina would have been welcome, which is the first time I'd ever had that depressing thought. I trudged along in the middle, trying to avoid flashbacks of my long-ago, unintended trip through a sewage treatment facility in Biloxi, Mississippi. That day would have been a total disaster, except that it ended with an impromptu jam session with Leadbelly. The current became stronger, pushing against us. Up ahead, I detected the glow of electric lights, the sound of voices. Leo extinguished his hand fire. He turned to us and put his finger to his lips. After another 20 feet, we arrived at a second set of golden bars. Beyond that, the sewer opened into a much larger space, where the water ran at a cross current, some of it diverting into our tunnel. The force of the outflow made it difficult to stand. Leo pointed at the golden grate. "This runs on a clepsydra lock," he said just loud enough to be heard. "I think I can open it quietly, but keep watch for me just in case. I don't know, giant serpents?" "We have faith in you, Valdez." I had no idea what a clepsydra lock was, but I'd learned from dealing with Hephaestus that it was best to show optimism and polite interest. Otherwise, the tinkerer took offense
and stopped making shiny toys for me to play with. Within moments, Leo had the grate open. No alarms sounded. No contact mines exploded in our faces. We emerged in the throne room I'd seen in my vision. Fortunately, we were neck deep in one of the open channels of water that lined the sides of the chamber, so I doubted anyone could easily spot us. Along the wall behind us, videos of Commodus looped over and over on the giant television screens. We trudged toward the opposite side of the channel. If you have ever tried to walk while immersed in a swift stream, you know how difficult it is. Also, if you have tried it, then may I ask why? It was absolutely exhausting. With every step, I feared the current would sweep me off my feet and flush me into the bowels of Indianapolis. Somehow, though, we made it to the far side. I peeked over the edge of the channel and was immediately sorry I did. Commodus was right there. Thank the gods we had crossed slightly behind his throne, so neither he nor his Germani guards saw me. My least favorite cornhusker, Laterces, knelt before the emperor, facing my direction, but his head was lowered. I ducked back below the edge before he could spot me. I gestured to my friends. Quiet. Yikes. We're going to die. Or something to that effect. They seemed to get the message. Shivering miserably, I pressed against the wall and listened to the conversation going on just above us.
Part of the plan, sire, Laterces was saying. We know where the way station is now.
Commodus grunted.
Yes, yes, old Union Station. But Cleander searched that place several times before and found nothing. The way station is there, Laterces insisted. The tracking devices I planted on the griffins worked perfectly. The place must be protected by some sort of magic, but it won't stand up to a fleet of Blemii bulldozers.
My heart climbed above water level, which put it somewhere between my ears. I dared not look at my friends. I had failed once again. I had unwittingly betrayed the location of our safe haven. Commodus sighed.
Fine, yes. But I want Apollo captured and brought to me in chains. The naming ceremony is tomorrow. Our dress rehearsal is, like, right now.
When can you have the way station destroyed? Laterces hesitated.
We need to scout the defenses and gather our forces. 2 days.
2 days.
I'm not asking you to cross the Alps. I want it to happen now.
Tomorrow, then, at the latest, sire, said Laterces.
Definitely by tomorrow. I'm beginning to wonder about you, son of Midas. If you don't deliver...
An electronic alarm blared through the chamber. For a moment, I thought we'd been discovered. I may or may not have emptied my bladder in the channel. Don't tell Leo. He was downstream. Then, from the other side of the room, a voice shouted in Latin.
Incursion at the front gates!
Laterces growled.
I will deal with this, sire. Never fear. Guards, with me!
Heavy footsteps faded into the distance. I glanced at Meg and Leo, who were both giving me the same silent question. What the Hades? I had not ordered an incursion at the front gates. I hadn't even activated the iron manacle on my ankle. I didn't know who would be so foolish as to launch a frontal assault on this underground palace. But Britomartis had promised to look for the hunters of Artemis.
It occurred to me that this was the sort of diversionary tactic they might arrange if they were trying to distract Commodus's security forces from our presence. Could we be so lucky? Probably not. More likely, some magazine subscription salesman had rung the Emperor's doorbell and was about to get a very hostile reception. I risked another peek over the edge of the canal. Commodus was alone now, with just one guard. Perhaps we could take him? 3-on-2? Except that we were all about to pass out from hypothermia. Meg probably had some broken ribs, and my own powers were unpredictable at best. On the opposing team, we had a trained barbarian killer and a semi-divine emperor with a well-deserved reputation for superhuman strength. I decided to stay put. Commodus glanced at his bodyguard.
Alaric.
Lord.
I think your time is approaching. I grow impatient with my prefect. How long has Laterces had this job?
About a day, my lord.
Seems like forever.
Commodus pounded his fist on his armrest.
As soon as he's dealt with this incursion, I want you to kill him.
Yes, lord.
I want you to wipe out the waystation tomorrow morning at the latest. Can you do that?
Of course, lord.
Good. We'll have the naming ceremony immediately afterward in the Colosseum.
Stadium, my lord.
Same difference. And the Cave of Prophecy? Is it secure?
My spine took a jolt of electricity so strong, I wondered if Commodus kept electric eels in the channel.
I have followed your orders, sire,
Alaric said.
The beasts are in place. The entrance is well guarded. None shall gain access.
Lovely.
Commodus jumped to his feet.
Now let's go try on our racing outfits for the dress rehearsal, shall we?
I can't wait to remake this city in my own image.
I waited until the sound of their footsteps receded. I peeked over and saw no one in the room.
Now,
I said. We dragged ourselves out of the canal and stood dripping and shivering in front of the golden throne. I could still smell the scent of Commodus's favorite body oil, a mix of cardamom and cinnamon. Meg paced for warmth, her swords glowing in her hands.
Tomorrow morning, we gotta warn Joe and Emmy.
Yeah, Leo agreed. But we stick to the plan. First, we find the captives, and that throne of whatever it is.
Memory,
I said.
Yeah, that. Then we get out of here and warn Joe and Emmy.
It may not help, I fretted. I've seen how Commodus remakes a city. There will be chaos and spectacle, fire and wholesale slaughter, and lots of pictures of Commodus everywhere. Add to that an army of Blemyai bulldozers. Apollo? Leo made a fiery timeout sign. We're gonna use the Valdez method on this. Meg frowned.
What's the Valdez method?
Don't overthink it, Leo said. It'll just make you depressed. In fact, try not to think at all.
Meg considered this, then seemed to realize she was thinking, then looked sheepish.
Okay.
Leo grinned.
See? Easy.
Now let's go blow some stuff up. 23.
So amaze. Such name. Sarah with 5 S's is still 2 syllables.
At first, the Valdez method worked fine. We found nothing to blow up, but we also didn't have to overthink anything. This was because we embraced the McCaffrey method as well, which involved chia seeds. Faced with a choice of which corridor to take from the throne room, Meg pulled a soggy package of seeds from her red high top. I did not ask why she kept seeds in her shoes. She caused the chia to sprout in her cupped palm, and the tiny forest of green stalks pointed toward the left-hand corridor.
That way,
Meg announced.
Awesome superpower, Leo said. When we get out of here, I'ma hook you up with a mask and a cape. We'll call you Chia Girl.
I hoped he was kidding. Meg, however, looked delighted. The chia sprouts led us down one corridor, then another. For an underground lair in the Indianapolis sewer system, the palace was quite opulent. The floors were rough-hewn slate, the gray stone walls decorated with alternating tapestries and television monitors showing, you guessed it, videos of Commodus. Most of the mahogany doors were labeled with engraved bronze plates. Commodus Sauna, Commodus Guest Rooms 1 through 6, Commodus Employee Cafeteria, and yes, Commodus Commodes. We saw no guards, no employees, no guests. The only person we encountered was a maid coming out of the Commodus Imperial Guard Barracks with a basket of dirty laundry. When she saw us, her eyes widened in terror, probably because we looked dirtier and damper than anything she'd pulled from the Germani's hamper. Before she could scream, I knelt before her and sang, "You Don't See Me" by Josie and the Pussycats. The maid's eyes became misty and unfocused. She sniffled nostalgically, walked back into the barracks, and closed the door behind her. Leo nodded. Nice one, Apollo.
It wasn't hard.
That tune is wonderful for inducing short-term amnesia. Meg sniffed. Would have been kinder to hit her over the head.
Oh, come now, I protested. You like my singing.
Her ears reddened. I remembered how young McCaffrey had cried when I poured out my heart and soul in the giant ant's lair at Camp Half-Blood. I'd been rather proud of my performance. But I guess Meg did not feel like reliving it. She punched me in the gut.
Come on.
Ow.
The chia seeds led us deeper into the Emperor's compound. Silence began to weigh on me. Imaginary insects crawled across my shoulder blades. Surely Commodus's men had dealt with the front door incursion by now. They would be returning to their normal posts, perhaps checking security monitors for other intruders. At last, we turned a corner and spotted a Blemyai keeping watch outside a metal vault door. The guard wore black dress pants and shiny black shoes, but he made no attempt to hide his chest face. The hair across his shoulders, scalp, was clipped in a military flat top. The wire of a security earpiece ran from beneath his armpit to his pants pocket. He did not appear to be armed, but that gave me no comfort. His meaty fists looked quite capable of crushing a pedal boat, or a Lester Papadopoulos. Leo grumbled under his breath. Not these guys again. Then he forced a smile and strode toward the guard.
Hello, lovely day. How are you?
The guard turned in surprise. I imagined that proper procedure would have been to alert his superiors to the intrusion, but he'd been asked a question. It would have been rude to ignore it. I'm fine. The guard couldn't seem to decide between a friendly smile or an intimidating glower. His mouth spasmed, which made him look like he was doing an ab exercise.
I don't think you're supposed to be here.
Really? Leo kept marching forward.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Now, if you'll please raise your hands.
Like this?
Leo ignited his hands and torched the Blemyai's chest face. The guard stumbled, choking on flames,
batting his huge eyelashes like burning palm fronds. He groped for the button on the microphone attached to his earpiece.
Post 12, he croaked. I've got...
Meg's twin golden swords scissored across his midsection, reducing him to a pile of yellow dust with a partially melted earpiece. A voice warbled from the tiny speaker.
Post 12? Please repeat.
I grabbed the device. I had no desire to wear something that had been in a Blemyai's armpit, but I held the speaker next to my ear and spoke into the mic. False alarm. Everything is hunky-dorky. Thank you.
You're welcome, said the voice on the speaker. Daily passcode, please.
Why, certainly. It's... I threw the microphone down and crushed it under my heel. Meg stared at me. Hunky dorky? It sounded like something a Blemyai would say. That's not even the right expression. It's hunky dory. A girl who says gaudy is correcting my language.
Guys, Leo said, keep a lookout while I take care of this door. There's gotta be something important in here.
I kept watch while he went to work on the vault lock. Meg, not being good at following directions, strolled back the way we'd come. She crouched and began picking up the chia sprouts she'd dropped when summoning her swords. Meg, I said.
Yeah?
What are you doing?
Chia.
I can see that, but I almost said they're only sprouts. Then I remembered one time I'd said something similar to Demeter. The goddess had cursed me so that every piece of clothing I put on immediately sprouted and bloomed. Nothing is quite as uncomfortable as having your cotton underwear burst into actual bowls of cotton, complete with stems, spurs, and seeds right where you're... Well, I think you get the idea. Meg gathered the last of her sprouts. With one of her swords, she cracked the slate floor. She carefully planted the chia in the fissure, then wrung out her still wet skirt to water them. I watched, fascinated, as the small patch of green thickened and flourished, forcing new cracks in the slate. Who knew chia could be so robust? They wouldn't last any longer in my hand. Meg stood, her expression defiant. Everything alive deserves a chance to grow. The mortal Lester part of me found this sentiment admirable. The Apollo part of me wasn't so sure. Over the centuries, I'd met many living beings that hadn't seemed worthy or even capable of growth. A few of those beings I'd killed myself. Still, I suspected Meg was saying something about herself. She had endured a horrid childhood. The death of her father, then the abuse of Nero, who'd twisted her mind into seeing him both as her kindly stepfather and the terrible beast. Despite that, Meg had survived. I imagined she could empathize with small green things that had surprisingly strong roots.
Yes,
Leo said. The vault lock clicked. The door swung inward. Leo turned and grinned.
Who's the best?
Me? I asked. But my spirits quickly fell. You didn't mean me, did you? Leo ignored me and stepped into the room. I followed. Immediately, an intense, unpleasant moment of deja vu struck me. Inside, a circular chamber was lined with glass partitions, like the Emperor's training facility at the zoo. But here, instead of animals, the cages held people. I was so appalled I could hardly breathe. In the nearest cell on my left, huddled in a corner, two painfully emaciated teenage boys glared at me. Their clothes were rags. Shadows filled the cavernous recesses of their clavicles and ribs.
In the next cell, a girl in gray camouflage paced like a jaguar. Her shoulder-length hair was stark white, though she looked no more than 15. Given her level of energy and outrage, I guessed she was a recent captive. She had no bow, but I pegged her as a hunter of Artemis. When she saw me, she marched to the glass. She banged on it with her fists and shouted angrily. But her voice was too muffled for me to make out the words. I counted 6 other cells, each one occupied. In the center of the room was a metal post with iron hooks and chains. The sort of place where one could fasten slaves for inspection before sale.
Madre de los dioses,
Leo muttered. I thought the arrow of Dodona was trembling in my quiver. Then I realized it was just me shaking with anger. I have always despised slavery. Partly, this is because twice before Zeus made me mortal and forced me to work as a slave for human kings. The most poetic description I can offer about that experience? It sucked. Even before that, my temple at Delphi had created a special way for slaves to gain their freedom. With the help of my priests, thousands bought their emancipation through a ritual called the Trust Sale, by which I, the god Apollo, became their new master and then set them free. Much later, one of my biggest grudges against the Romans was that they turned my holy island of Delos into the region's biggest slave market. Can you believe the nerve? I sent an angry army led by Mithridates to correct that situation, slaughtering 20,000 Romans in the process. But I mean, come on. They had it coming. Suffice to say, Commodus's prison reminded me of everything I hated about the good old days. Meg strode to the cell that held the 2 emaciated boys. With the point of her sword, she cut a circle in the glass and kicked it in. The dislodged section wobbled on the floor like a giant transparent coin. The boys tried to stand without success. Meg jumped into the cell to help them. Yeah. Leo muttered with approval. He pulled a hammer from his tool belt and marched to the cell of the captive hunter. He gestured, "Get back," then whacked the glass. The hammer bounced off, narrowly missing Leo's nose on the rebound. The hunter rolled her eyes. "Okay, Mr. Sheet of Glass." Leo tossed aside the hammer. "You're gonna be like that. It's on." His hands blazed white hot. He pressed his fingers against the glass, which began to warp and bubble. Within seconds, he melted a ragged hole at face level. The silver-haired girl said, "Good. Step aside." "Hold on. I'll make you a bigger exit," Leo promised.
"No need."